The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main engine
hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Monday Space Show program, the first Monday for the program of the new year, 2015. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. I am your host, David Livingston. Absolutely gorgeous day in the Bay Area. Kind of chilly, but a nice day. I hope wherever you are, it's equally nice. And we have a good show for you today, a good way to be starting off the new year. But first, our toll-free number, please write it down. You may want to give a call to our guest, Dr. John Brandenburg, who I'll introduce in a moment. Toll-free 1-866-687-7223. We also accept email, and the email address is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And a couple of other things about the Space Show. We are copyrighted and trademarked, but you do have permission to download all of our shows and freely distribute them on the net to people who you think may be interested, should be interested, must be interested, and will be interested. Don't do anything commercial with the shows. Please don't edit them. And in addition, written transcripts are not permissible, even if they're for your own personal use. And that's the same for the edits, too. So, like, if you have a private YouTube channel or something, that applies. Please don't edit the programs. And we appreciate your following those simple guidelines. But do share them. Do help get the word out. Remember that we podcast, and Andrew Grummet at gigadial.net is our podcasting client. And you can find our podcast on iTunes and a host of other places on the net as well. So check it out. If you have any podcasting-related questions, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and I'll be happy to do my best to answer them for you. The RSS URL to subscribe to our podcast is on our website and both of our newsletters. Again, let me hear from you if you have any questions. Our website is thespaceshow.com. So there you will find in the middle of the page a fairly comprehensive newsletter. And this newsletter is typically published Sunday after the Sunday Space Show or no later than Sunday evening. But it may be midnight Sunday evening if I'm rushing out the door after the Sunday show. So do check that because that has all of the details of the week's program. It has the guest bios. And then if we have to modify our program during the week for any reason, this is where we do it first. And it's also the only place where we have a coming events section of the Space Show, what's ahead in the next couple of weeks. So do check out the website newsletter. Then also you can subscribe to the very short email newsletter, and that goes out early Monday morning, California time, 6 a.m., and it's so short it won't clutter up your email box, I promise you. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our websites or our blog, or you can easily download the shows. The blog is http://thespaceshow.wordpress.com. There's a store up at the top of the left-hand corner. It's called Space Show Store, so do check it out. And then, of course, there is the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with the One Giant Leap Foundation.org, and that's our 501c3. And if you do donate, remember, if you're paying U.S. federal taxes, you do get a deduction. The same is true for those of you honored and blessed to be paying California taxes. So if you have any questions about this, do check with your tax advisor, or you can send a note to me, and I'll do my very best to answer the question for you. And that does bring me to today's one more announcement that I always need to
say. One more announcement.
Yeah, it is that we're partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation. I don't want to slight our sponsor.
Right.
Secure World, especially since they do really cool work, they promote cooperative solutions for space security. They sponsor our webinar series. For more information, go to their website, swfound.org. And again, great organization, so check them out. Now I can tell you about the person who really needs no introduction. Dr. John Brandenburg is back with us. He has a brand new book called Death on Mars. I'm holding it in my hand. The Discovery of a Planetary Nuclear Massacre by Little Green Men on the Martian South Pole. And John, it's a great book, and really and truly the full name of the book is Death on Mars, The Discovery of a Planetary Nuclear Massacre, which John has talked about before on the space show. John is actually a real scientist, and so he knows what he's talking about. He is a plasma physicist and a senior propulsion scientist at Orbital Technologies Corporation in Madison, Wisconsin. He is the author of many books, including Beyond Einstein's Unified Field, Life and Death on Mars, and Cosmic Jesus. He appears on various radio shows other than the space show. We do give him permission to do that.
Oh, thank you.
And he talks on the television, and he writes killer, and I mean killer, sci-fi under a different name. But we'll get him to talk about that as well during the show. If you
sure.
If you like science fiction stories rooted in by someone who really knows space, as John does, you will love his science fiction stories. Death on Mars, nuclear massacre. John, I do so many shows with people from NASA, Curiosity.
I know
you do. You know, this mission, that mission. And they talk about what's in the Mars atmosphere. MAVEN is up there. And,
sure.
And you're the only guy who talks about these isotopes in the Martian atmosphere that can be traced. And the only rational explanation for them is there are some nuke explosions on Mars. So why is that? Are you a kook on the fringe, or are they unwilling to look at this, or... For the non-scientists like me,
am I a madman?
Yeah. So for the non-scientists like me, and I'm being serious.
I know.
Why is that?
Well, it's the end of a long road.
What do you mean the end of a long road?
Detective story, like Sherlock Holmes says, you finally eliminate the impossible, and what you're left with is, however improbable, must be the truth. Now, I began this investigation because the isotopes in the Martian atmosphere, xenon 129, is predominant. And that is a produced on Earth. It's a component. There's a component of the Earth's atmosphere that has appeared since 1945 that has a big spike in xenon 129. And, due to nuclear power. And since we've had that since 1945, so I assumed that there had been some kind of nuclear activity on Mars. Now, on Earth, we have natural nuclear reactors. There were like 20 different locations in these very rich uranium deposits in Africa, and nature managed this little experiment of nuclear power very well. Water would get into the uranium deposit. This is like a billion years ago, so the uranium was actually reactor grade in those days because the U-235 hadn't decayed as much. And so then the neutrons would be moderated by the water, and just like they are in a regular power reactor in the present day. And you would get it would go critical, start producing all this nuclear power, and then it would get hot and drive the water out. And then it would shut down. And so it would cycle like that for millions of years, apparently. And in the process, it burned up a considerable amount of the uranium-235, and that's why when they were digging through the uranium deposits in they at first thought somebody was stealing some of the uranium. Uranium-235 is very expensive. You know, you get a lot of money for it. And the French assumed that somebody was stealing some of the uranium-235 out of the deposits. But then they realized, no, this is raw ore. It hasn't been disturbed. Something burned up the uranium-235. Then they looked at the pattern of isotopes and determined that that fission had occurred, producing a series of isotopes like, you know, strontium-90 and cesium-137, et cetera, or iodine-129 is another one. That's why they pass out iodine whenever there's a big nuclear accident, to get so the body won't uptake this radioactive iodine. So there are all sorts of studies one can do on the isotopes. If you suspect there was a nuclear reaction, you can study the isotopes, and there are people who just make their living doing this. And you can figure out what kind of reaction caused it. And in fact, every time North Korea tries to set off an atomic bomb, they immediately analyze the atmosphere around. They have planes that go scoop up chunks of as much atmosphere as they can around North Korea and analyze the isotopes in the air to see what kind of bomb it was, how big it was, so forth. You can actually deduce an enormous amount of information just from the isotopes. Now, on Mars, we had all the xenon-129. We also had a global pattern of thorium and radioactive potassium spread over the surface, radiating from one large radioactive scar. And it looked like a global debris pattern, like shock waves had gone from this one place, crashed into each other on the far side of the planet, and deposited a bunch of radioactive ash, you know, at a spot, what's called the antipode, exactly opposite from the original area. And then there was a smaller radioactive hot spot nearby, and these were in the north of Mars. One was at what place called Mare Acidalium, and the other one is at Utopia Planum. So as I was digging into this, I discovered the meteorites from Mars. Some of them show evidence of being irradiated heavily with neutrons. And most of the Mars meteorites don't show this, but the youngest ones do. And so radiometrically, it's like 200 million years old. And so, Dave, this was a very, very interesting detective story. So I started going to conferences and presenting this hypothesis that there had been a natural nuclear reactor on Mars, a large one, that had gone unstable and, as they say, explosively disassembled. That's a reactor talk for it blew up.
Okay, let me stop you.
Sure.
What, there are all different kinds of conferences. So, you know, you could go to the Mars Society or ISDC or Space Frontier Foundation or something like that, or you could go to a peer-reviewed professional, you know, triple E or AAA or AIAA or even some more that are compartmentalized to physics and things like that. So where your papers are actually reviewed to be submitted?
Well, I presented at the American Geophysical Union.
Okay, so that's credible.
They reviewed my abstract and accepted it. And then I finally presented it at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference.
Okay.
Which is heavily reviewed.
Heavily. Did you get booed off the stage or what happened?
No, I gave a poster session, and people found it interesting. Basically the place where it got really evaluated was when they decided to accept it for the conference. And several people commented that, of course, if you had natural nuclear reactors on Earth, you would find them on Mars.
But then why don't we find them on other planets?
We haven't. Mars is one of the most heavily investigated planets in the solar system. I mean, we haven't investigated like Mercury or Venus. We can't get close to Venus. One of the advantages of Mars is the atmosphere is so thin that gamma rays go right through it. So you can actually read the isotopes by the different spectrum of gamma rays from the surface. And you can't do that on, like, Venus because the atmosphere is too dense. You have to actually land there, and, of course, you might as well you have to put your spacecraft instruments inside kind of a pressure cooker so they won't be immediately crushed.
What about Mercury?
They have done some investigations of Mercury, but they haven't found anything like this pattern is on Mars.
And the gas giants, this is not applicable to them?
That's not applicable, yeah. They don't have actually solid surfaces. Anything like anything involving uranium would probably sink to the core where they have the planet Jupiter is a giant peach, and then it's got a pit where all of the really heavy stuff collects. The rest of it is basically a slush of methane and ammonia and stuff like that. So I presented all these papers, presented these places, you know, at peer-reviewed conferences, and basically took comments from scientists who were thinking about this, and they all thought it was very interesting. And the problem, though, is they would come back where they say, well, if it was an underground nuclear reactor, you know, in the soil from like a buried asteroid, it would have, and it exploded, it would have left an enormous crater. I mean, if you put, the secret to plastic explosive is you actually stick it on the girder you're trying to blow up. If you put it away a few inches, it won't do anything to a steel girder. But you put the explosive on the girder, and the explosive force actually goes into the girder preferentially because, technical arguments. Basically, it goes in the direction where it's the force it's most opposed, in effect. It goes in the path of more resistance rather than least resistance. And so if you had something detonated, which this would have had to have detonated to spread debris around the planet, it would have had to have left a large crater. And the other thing I found out was that the Xenon-129 in the atmosphere of Earth was not there due to regular nuclear reactors that use what are called moderated neutrons. No, it was fast neutrons. It was due to the weapons program, nuclear testing, and plutonium production, both of which require fast neutrons. So to make plutonium, you have to use special nuclear reactors that support fast neutrons, and so that you can create the plutonium from uranium-238. And this is what creates the xenon-129 in the Earth's atmosphere. Bombs going off and then plutonium production. In investigating the dark secrets of Mars, I stumbled onto the dark secrets of Earth. I discovered just how addicted to nuclear weapons this species is. And so what happened is we discovered that, myself, and I bounced this off various colleagues who were cognizant of it, is that this, whatever happened on Mars, especially there's two places, one very large and the other one somewhat smaller, had to have exploded in midair. And the explosion involved fast neutrons, not moderated neutrons like a natural nuclear reactor. Natural nuclear reactors run just like a regular reactor with water moderation.
Uh-huh.
And so you can tell from the spectrum of isotopes whether it was a weapon signature or just a nuclear reactor signature, and it's a weapon signature. So this, of course, happens. Oh, and then the Mars meteorites, the young ones that were exposed to a lot of neutrons, they found out that the neutrons that hit them were actually high-energy neutrons. They were like 10 MeV neutrons, 10 million electron volt neutrons. They were nothing like would be produced by fission. This is like when a hydrogen bomb goes off, it releases 14 million electron volt neutrons, and they are so powerful, they actually split the atoms of uranium-238 and thorium, which are normally inert. So whatever happened on Mars was a fast neutron event, and it happened in midair. And that's extremely difficult to explain with any There are no known natural processes that do that. The only process known that does things like that is a nuclear weapon going off.
So, going back to what I said earlier, why aren't these isotopes and these things mentioned as part of the Martian atmosphere when you talk to these NASA scientists and mission analysts and people, you know, trying to look for signs of this or that in the Martian atmosphere?
Well, the Mars science has a series of important questions it wants to answer. Like, how long was liquid water on the surface of Mars?
Right.
Was there plate tectonics? What happened to Mars' atmosphere? Mars' atmosphere seems to have been much denser in the past. And that's why they're orbiting the MAVEN around Mars to look at the rate at which the solar wind at Mars is stripping away parts of the Martian atmosphere. And if you're on a team investigating, and I've worked on teams involved in various projects, you are not expected to go off and ask a lot of other questions. You're supposed to concentrate on the main question, because that's where the money is. That's what the grant says you're supposed to investigate.
But don't they know that Xenon 129 is in the Martian atmosphere?
Oh, yes, they do.
Okay, and doesn't that make them...
It's just considered a puzzle. I've seen... Xenon 129 in nature, when the solar system started out, the solar system was radioactive. It was the solar system was apparently formed by the explosion of a supernova somewhere nearby, which fortunately didn't leave any neutron stars or black holes nearby to cause us trouble later. But what happened was the universe, the solar system, condensed out of a cloud of elements that was right out of the core of a supernova. So there was all sorts of radioactive stuff. And they see traces of that in meteors that come from the asteroid belt. The asteroid belt gives us really raw material from the beginning of the solar system, the primordial dust. And you can actually see traces of extinct or the daughter products of radioactive nuclei. So it's all, you can do an elaborate detective story about what actually helped form the solar system, apparently a supernova explosion. So when you arrive on, when Mars condenses like Earth, they end up with basically a ration of various isotopes. On Earth and in the solar wind, which comes from the sun, and in the lunar dust, and in the meteorites, xenon 129 is present, and xenon 132 is also present, and they're present in equal quantities. And they put a probe into the atmosphere of Jupiter and discovered the same thing. It has basically a solar spectrum of xenon isotopes. Only Mars has this excess of 129. Now, xenon-129 can come from iodine-129, which has a decay half-life of about 12 million years. So you can say, okay, the solar system formed, and Mars, for some reason, got more iodine-129 than other places. But then there's another problem, is that the Mars atmosphere seems to have all been, the original Mars atmosphere seems to have been lost fairly early on. And a few million years is nothing in the formation of the solar system. So Mars should have lost all of this xenon 129 if there had been an excess. Because the half-life of iodine is short. What happened then is it developed a whole bunch of argon-40, which is another product of radioactive decay from potassium. And Mars has an enormous load of argon-40. So, but argon-40 comes from potassium, which has a billion-year half-life. So you'd have to say that the explanation for the argon-40 is, oh, Mars lost its original atmosphere, but that would have meant it lost all of xenon-129. So it's it's a detective story. Now, basically, we have the only other example in the solar system of an excess of xenon 129 is in Earth's atmosphere, and that's due to the weapons program. So, in addition, now we have found at the site of the two radioactive hotspots on Mars of radioactive potassium and thorium, glass, as if formed by a nuclear explosion in midair. When they set off the first nuclear weapon on Earth, it was called the Trinity event.
Right, in New Mexico.
And it created what's called trinitite, it's green glass. It turned the desert into green glass. And they have found similar, you know, what looks like similar glass. And the glass has been etched with nitric acid, which is normally formed by a big fireball in an atmosphere with oxygen available, like CO2 or something. So it's a detective story. And you finally say, okay, something apparently blew up on Mars, created all this isotopes. It was a fast neutron event, and it happened in midair. And it was so powerful, it spread shockwaves all the way around the planet so that they collided on the far side of the planet and left a pile of debris. And you say, suddenly you're not talking about what looks like natural events. You're talking about things that look very familiar, but which are not natural. They are caused by people, intelligence. So, in one sense, I wrote the book because I thought somebody had to bell the cat. Might as well be me.
Okay.
Let me tell you something, Dave. To discover anything, like Freud discovering the subconscious, that we were all sex-crazed maniacs in our heart of hearts, Darwin discovering that our ancient ancestors was not the Earl of Sunderland, but some monkey swinging from a tree. People don't like hearing these things. It unnerves them. But somebody has to say them. So I'm not saying I'm Freud. I'm not saying I'm Darwin. I'm just saying.
You are saying you're sex crazed.
I'm not trying to speak for the whole human race. Of course, I know most of the human race is very staid, doesn't think about sex except maybe once a year.
You have a listener, Michael, who says, are you familiar with J. Marvin Herndon? And if you are,
yes.
Have you collaborated with him on natural reactors on Mars?
J. Herndon and I actually had several nice discussions. He looked at my research and decided that he has enough trouble with his natural nuclear reactor on Earth. And he's trying to explain why certain isotopes come out of the volcanoes in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he decided one controversy at a time. So I decided this would be my controversy. But we did have a nice chat.
Did he?
I was referred to him by several scientists who saw my paper at the American Geophysical Union.
Did he concur with your analysis?
I'd rather not speak to him, but he seemed to think it was quite reasonable. As I said, the natural nuclear reactor hypothesis, very few people disagreed with that interpretation of the events that when I put all of the data in one paper, they said, yes, that looks like a reasonable hypothesis. And several of them said, well, if there were natural nuclear reactors on Earth, there had to have been natural nuclear reactors on Mars because we have water and we have uranium. And that's all you need, basically, groundwater and uranium. And we know that from the Mars meteorites that there was a lot of groundwater on Mars. The Mars meteorites, several of them, show signs of interacting with groundwater. And so that they were soaked, basically, before they were shot into space. to end up on Earth. So it's a fascinating aspect of Mars science. The only problem in this case is the answer is sort of forbidden. Like I've said, I've connected one too many dots, and I realize that. But you must, as you, in the book Death on Mars, which you've read, you know, you see that I did not get into Mars research because I was really interested in Mars, particularly. I was interested in Mars as a scientist, but I'm a plasma physicist. I trained to work on thermonuclear fusion, for, you know, controlled thermonuclear fusion to make the Earth a warmer, safer place in the future. Energy too cheap to meter was our goal. And I ended up, because the Cold War got really hot at that point under Reagan, I ended up having to work on directed energy weapons. That is, if I wanted to work as a plasma physicist, I could have gotten a job as a grocer. I can run a cash register.
So
and my till's always balanced pretty well, within about a nickel.
Did you work on weapons?
I didn't work on nuclear weapons, but I certainly worked on directed energy weapons. And one of the things I did, though, at Livermore was I worked on laser fusion for about 2 years. Now, laser fusion is making little miniature hydrogen bombs. And I'm sorry, and I don't hope this doesn't ruin anyone's day, but the whole laser fusion program is an extension of the weapons program. The idea that we're going to make power too cheap to meter out of little explosions of little miniature hydrogen bombs, that's pretty hard to swallow. As far as engineering practicability, it is a very useful experiment, but it is not intended for generating useful nuclear power for the grid. The tokamak that they're building over in France, the ITER, that is far more reasonable as far as producing power. Now, what has happened is that laser fusion relies heavily. Laser fusion is attempting to build on success the hydrogen bomb. The hydrogen bomb works. And they're basically trying to miniaturize the hydrogen bomb and still get it to work. Now, a hydrogen bomb is set off by an atomic bomb. Instead of a laser, they're using an atomic bomb. And this happens, this used to all be classified, by the way. This happens in a watermelon-shaped casing called a holrom. They set off the atomic bomb at one end. There's a ball of hydrogen and lithium isotopes at the other. The shock waves converge on the ball of hydrogen isotopes, compress it into a star, basically. They create instant gravity to make it into a star, in effect. And then the hydrogen reaction produces enormous amount of energy. You amplify the energy of the atomic bomb, the initial atomic bomb. Now, the real connoisseurs in nuclear weapons research make the casing out of uranium, because then the uranium splits. You can read this on Wikipedia. This used to be classified. It's no longer classified. And so it's on Wikipedia. So the uranium casing actually doubles the yield of the hydrogen bomb.
Cool.
So, like I said, the real connoisseurs do this.
So is this what they did on Mars?
It looks like it.
Okay, so I have a question that I've been holding here from Jim. From Jim in Boston, so I got to get you to come up for air here.
Okay.
Jim in Boston says, if you ruled out a natural nuclear explosion, then that leaves one to think someone or something caused it, and the question is, what is that someone or something?
I'm sorry, the person in Boston, his name is...
Jim.
Jim, you've hit the nail right on the head. Once you rule out any known natural process, then you are left with something unnatural. And all I can say is, it's somebody like us. If you want to know, there's a...
Wait a minute.
There's a principle called mediocrity. It's the foundation of SETI.
Mediocrity. Wasn't that a movie also, or maybe?
I think so. Yes, it's the study of the mediocre, the commonplace, the run of the mill, the C student.
Okay. Study of the C student. With $100,000.
Well, it turns out we imagine that we are A students in the cosmos.
Okay.
Actually, we are C students. And there are plenty. The cosmos is dominated by C students. That's why it begins with the letter C. So mediocrity says that the human race is not remarkable. The Earth is not remarkable. Life on Earth is not remarkable. We are unremarkable. We are commonplace. We are as common as stones, round stones by a riverbed. And that's why when we do SETI, we're saying we're looking for signals that we recognize because the people out there are going to be sort of like us. Because we're just C students. We're looking for other C students. The A students probably won't talk to us because they're in the Torch Honor Society. That was at my high school. And they were a bunch of really stuck-up people who didn't talk to me. And so, anyway, mediocrity says, if you want to know what intelligent life behaves like in the universe, turn on the news. I'm sorry. And so, Jim, does that kind of... So under mediocrity, we have dropped atomic bombs on people. And they were airbursts, by the way. They didn't create big craters because they're airbursts. They do that because it makes better shockwave effects on soft targets. So have I answered your question, Jim?
Well, he did it by email. We'll have to wait for a response to him.
Look for somebody like Governor Tarkin, Jim. not Jabba the Hutt, but more somebody like Governor Tarkin who have done something like this.
So then what you're postulating is that at some point in the history of Mars, there was life on Mars of some sort.
Well, let's just say that the Sugar Plum Fairy did not do these things. Something on Mars happened which caused very large nuclear weapons to be detonated in midair over Mars. And then you say, why would anyone do that? Would they do that to their own planet? And if they did that to their own planet, why would they lob the bombs into the air when setting them off on the ground would be perfectly adequate? If they wanted to destroy their own planet, why would they? You get into questions like this, assuming this was a rational act by somebody. You know, maybe its motivation was irrational, but at least it was a rational act, carefully planned, like a murder, you know. Then you have to imagine, why would they be set off in midair? And why would they be so large?
Okay, I'm going to stop you again. So,
sure.
First of all, I'm getting lots of emails. Listeners,
excellent.
Why don't you all pick up the phone and call the show? Come on, make my life easy. Okay, before I do some of these emails, you're judging the event as a weapon.
Yes.
Based on your human experience here on Earth.
That's right.
But is there this is so far out, I feel like I'm doing coast to coast or something.
I know. We're talking about a science fiction scenario like
right.
Dark
well,
Star.
Is there a way that some other living, I don't even know how to phrase the question, living entity or something might not have seen these as a weapon? And therefore, your weapon hypothesis is BS, and it was something totally different, but maybe the effect is the same as a weapon, but to them, it wasn't a weapon. Maybe they were blasting to create a new building or something, and it got out of control.
Perhaps they were trying to terraform Mars or something.
Or something. So is there... any other way without being a total whack job to look at this other than a weapon? I guess that's my question. We're talking about life that may...
Nature likes big explosions. Yeah, every time a big asteroid hits Mars, it creates a big explosion like this.
Uh-huh.
You know, Chicxulub wiped out all the dinosaurs. That was not a weapon. That was just an accident. You know, that was just... That was a tragic instance in the cosmos. Supernovas go off. They sterilize all life for 18 light years. When these gamma ray bursters happen, it probably sterilizes everything out to 100 light years. Nature likes big explosions. Now, the only question is, what could have caused this big explosion to happen in midair? And it had high-energy neutrons, and it was full of thorium and uranium. The Russians detected the uranium all over Mars. The surface of Mars is covered with a thin layer of uranium and thorium and radioactive potassium. We get the Mars rocks, and they're depleted. They don't have as much uranium and thorium as the surface layer, the top few centimeters, has.
Uh-huh.
That means there has to be a debris layer all over the planet. And so you think, what could cause that? Maybe, now, a weapon, when I say a weapon, that conveys intelligent purposes, and perhaps it is correct to say we don't know what the purpose of this was. It just happened. Somebody did it, and it happened. But it does not look natural.
Do you have a caller? Are you ready for this?
All right.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you?
This is Tim from Huntsville.
Okay.
Okay. Here's the question I want to ask you about.
Sure.
Could you tell us how long you projected this occurred?
How long?
This probably occurred about half a billion to a quarter billion years ago. This is a long time ago. We know that because the isotopes, the radioactive scar on Mars in the Mare Acidalium. And you, by the way, you can go on the web and look up potassium maps and thorium maps of Mars, and you'll see what I'm talking about. The big red spot on Mars in radioactivity, in gamma rays. Now, those are very long-lived isotopes. If you set off an atomic bomb someplace and irradiate the place with neutrons, the potassium will get radioactive, and it will stay radioactive for, I believe it's about a billion years. And thorium also is a very long-lived, like 12 billion years. So these are very long-lived isotopes. They have long memories. However, the shorter-lived isotopes, like iron, silicon, don't show anything like this pattern. It's only the very long-lived isotopes. Therefore, we can infer that whatever happened a long time ago. So the other isotopes are no longer, they all half-lived out. Only the long-lived ones remember this or maintain a pattern of this.
Now, is there any other sources of Xeon-129?
Well, Xeon-129, in terms of a planetary scale, there's no known source for Xeon-129. Except a supernova, but that produces a lot of xenon-132 also in equal amounts. That's a supernova. But xenon-129 can be found in some minerals concentrated because they concentrated iodine for some reason. Iodine-129 has a 12 billion year half-life. So, like, bacteria can pick up the xenon-129 and concentrate it, like seaweed, etc. And then that'll all decay, and then you'll get a bunch of xenon-129 as a leftover. But those are very small fractions of, like, meteors. They find in magnetite grains, they find xenon-129. Those are very tiny amounts of things in apparently that concentrated iodine-129 for some reason, maybe biological. That's normally where you would find xenon-129 unless it was produced promptly in a fast neutron event.
Tim, what else?
Okay, now what about an asteroid or meteor, a large meteorite,
mm-hmm.
that may have a large amount of radioactive material in it, and it explodes in the atmosphere. Would that be caused?
That would be another hypothesis. However, you know, we've picked up a lot of we have the moon, we've done mapping of the moon, we have Earth. We've even done looking at Mercury, and we have a lot of meteorites in the museums, and none of them show any evidence of concentrating a lot of radioactive stuff in them. I mean, there's no example you can give of this occurring anywhere else. So it's a unique situation on Mars without any, and, you know, we're dealing with the atmosphere of an entire planet. And like I said, the only place we find it, anything like it, is on Earth since 1945.
Okay. Anything else, Tim?
Thank you, Tim. Those are very good questions.
All right. Just a little off topic, but you mentioned that you were in fusion research?
Yes.
Okay. Of all the small fusion startup companies, which one has the most sound reactor design? Or
let's see. I better consult my legal department before there's big money chasing this now. The people who can build a compact fusion reactor that'll fit on the back of a truck, or at least a semi-trailer, they are going to become very, very rich.
Yeah, but they hadn't really given much detail to their
reactor. I noticed they don't. The one I'm most familiar with, because I actually worked on the experiment that inspired it, it's a company out of Washington State. With an investigator named John Slow, I think it's Math Sciences Northwest. They have a very good design that uses two colliding smoke rings of plasma. That's a good one.
But you know, I think about
the one from the Skunk Works.
Mm-hmm.
I look at that design and I see, well, gee, it looks sort of like it would work, but the problem is they haven't shown up at any meetings and given us details. You know, how many neutrons did they, how many fusion reactions did they make, et cetera? What kind of plasmas did they make? Normally, in the fusion research field, when it was running red hot, we'd have this one or two big meetings a year where everybody would go and literally strut their stuff. They would show all their best results. In fact, it drove progress. Everyone would push really hard to make scientific progress just ahead of these meetings so they could go and brag about it. And everybody was very competitive. But everyone showed what they were doing. You know, there was none of this, this is a trade secret, or we'd show you all the details, but we're filing patents right and left, et cetera. When big money gets involved, people start getting secretive, but that means that you can't, a plasma physicist like me, it's hard for me to evaluate an idea when people are keeping back important details. Like the Skunk Works thing looks good from a plasma physics perspective. However, from a reactor perspective, I don't understand how they're supposed to produce a lot of power from it. It looks like most of the plasma would stream out the ends of it before it would actually react. So, and I've spent a lot of time working on this stuff. So some parts of it, the Skunk Works thing looks interesting. It looks like a stable plasma, but the problem is the plasma wouldn't, it looks like it would just stream out the ends. I don't understand why they're claiming that this is such a big breakthrough. But people who are firing smoke rings of plasma into each other that then stick together, though I know that works because it was done by a fellow named Wells, Daniel Wells, called the Triceps, started that, and we tested his idea, and it worked really well. And then other people picked it up. So, but I can't give advice. My lawyer, my legal department has just arrived, and they said I can't give advice on buying stock in any of these companies.
No, I'm not talking about buying stock. I'm asking from a standpoint.
Tim, we got to take a break and move on. So,
sure, Tim. Thanks for your question.
Okay.
Thank you.
No problem.
Listeners, we're going to take a short break. I've got two emails here to read from Doug and Kirk. And others are coming in, and of course the toll-free number is available for any of you who dare to talk to Dr. Brandenburg, 1-866-687-7223. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Monday show. Dr. John Brandenburg is our guest today. We're talking about his book, Death on Mars, The Discovery of a Planetary Nuclear Massacre, and we're talking about what kind of nuclear explosion there might have been on Mars. I have Marshall on hold on the line, two emails to read. I'll take Kirk's email first, and then we'll go to Marshall. So Kirk says, how large would these explosions have been? And how large a device would have been necessary to create them?
The calculations one can make from the neutron irradiation of the Mars rocks, the amount of radioactive debris spread around the planet, and also the amount of xenon-129 produced, makes it look like it was a billion megatons. This is a nuclear weapon. If it was a nuclear weapon, it was as large as the Empire State Building, dropped out of space.
That's pretty big.
Yes, it is. People did not do this as a hobby. If people did this, they did not do this. They had a reason to do this. This is a well-planned, rational thing, even if its motivation was irrational.
So in contrast, the biggest nuclear weapon ever dropped, I think, on Earth was the Soviet Union.
The Tsar Bomba.
Wasn't it the Soviet Union at 100 megatons?
Well, it was only 50 megatons. That's because they didn't put a uranium jacket around it. And they did that because uranium jacket produces a lot of fallout. So they put a lead jacket around it that just burned up. They could have easily doubled the yield to 100 megatons, but they only went for 50. As it was quite impressive.
And we did not blow anything off that big, did
we? No, we went 25. I think the biggest one we set off was 25 megatons. Russians wanted to do us one better. And I'm sure there were several scientists that went to their bosses and urged, can't we build one of these things?
So you're saying a billion megatons. So we're talking megatons. I don't divide 50 into a billion.
Yeah.
I mean,
this is
much, much even bigger than what North Korea does.
You know, 20 million, 200 million times larger. In fact, it's what's bizarre is that most of the energy would have just gone out into space. It was, you know, if you set that off in the atmosphere, like Earth's atmosphere, it would blow off most of the Earth's atmosphere, but most of the energy would just be wasted into space.
Why wouldn't it destroy the planet and turn it into little chunks of rock?
Well, you know, it's rock, and it's held together by gravity. That takes a Death Star.
Let's see what Marshall has to say. We're ready for you, Marshall.
Yeah, Marshall, thanks for being patient.
Oh, well, quote unquote, I just had my topic covered.
Oh, my God.
Well.
I'll have to take a little twisted tact here. You were earlier talking about natural nuclear reactions.
Natural nuclear reactions.
Water and so on. Could that have been done in any of the Martian volcanoes and left an appropriate scar on the planet?
Interesting thing is the scar, the radioactive scar. And if you can go on, you can go online and look up maps of potassium and maps of thorium on Mars, and you'll see this big red spot in Mare Acidalium, and then a smaller one in Utopia Planum. They aren't anywhere near the volcanoes.
Ooh, very interesting.
It is. It's like I said. It's worthy. This is Sherlock Holmes saying, "Why didn't the dog bark?"
Yes.
Why didn't the dog bark? I've got a perfectly good scenario that fits all the facts, except for the dog. The dog didn't bark. That means it had to. You know,
it had to be another conclusion.
There has to be another possibility out there that explains everything, including the dog barking. And so it's a. Now, some people have criticized me for connecting this to Cydonia. And the connection is all I have to do is read a map.
Yeah.
The prevailing wind direction. By the way, Mars has a wind pattern similar to Earth. The winds in the north are what are called Coriolis effect winds.
Mm-hmm.
They come down from the poles, and then they twist into a vortex because of the rotation of Mars, which is the same rotation rate as Earth. So they end up blowing from the north, they blow to the southeast, basically. Mm-hmm. That's why the west coast gets, Pacific Northwest gets all that rain from the Gulf of Alaska.
Yep.
And that's why we get also the Canadian Express, and if you live in the northeast.
Now, which is going to be freezing them next week.
If you look at the winds on Mars, where all the fallout, and in fact, the strongest shock waves are always downwind.
Mm-hmm.
The shock waves get amplified by the wind. And so Cydonia is right downwind of where these things went off. And at Utopia Planum, it's the Elysium, Galaxius Chaos area. And, you know, it's hard enough talking about big nuclear weapons. We'll just leave it at that. I can read a map. Yeah. And so that's how the connection is made to the other stuff on Mars. The other big boot. There are two big boots that are going to drop on Mars. One of them, the first one, is this one. And then, yes. So, no, the radioactive debris is not near the volcanoes.
Mm-hmm. So there isn't any natural radioactive piles that have been detected at all? Because that would be really cool. Use it as a power source for Martian colony. But
here's another fascinating thing. Martian atmosphere is loaded with argon-40, which is the decay of radioactive potassium.
Yep.
And then it's and then there's also the uranium and thorium. And the Russians were the first pure persons to detect all of this on the surface of Mars. But then we get the Mars meteorites, which are subsurface rock. They were rock that is buried like 10 or 20 feet deep on Mars, got blown into space. When they look at simulations of asteroids plowing into Mars to kick rocks into space, the surface rocks don't go into space. It's the stuff from 20, 30 feet below. So that's the basement rock, the bedrock on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
You look at those rocks, they have much less potassium and uranium and thorium than Earth rock, about one-tenth. So uranium and thorium, which are good nuclear fuels, are rather sparse on Mars. And the other thing is potassium, which is, normally found in a lot of Earth rocks, that also appears to be much scarcer on Mars. And that, the fact that you have all of this gas that's normally associated with the decay of radioactive potassium, and then you look at the rocks and there's hardly any potassium in them, that's another weird mystery of Mars.
Mm-hmm. And that basically says the nuclear-powered colony on Mars is going to have some problems.
Well, it'll have to work hard to get that uranium out of the rocks. It'll just They'll have to find a nice uranium-rich asteroid and bring it to Mars from the asteroid belt. Asteroid belt's pretty close. So,
mm-hmm. They'll have to be
very inventive.
Yep. Anyway, that sounds like more fun than I'm allocated to have. So let's let somebody else have some fun.
Thank you, Marshall.
Thank you for your questions, though.
Okay, Doug has been waiting patiently for me to ask
him. Yes, Doug.
Now, well, it's by email. Don't jump the gun here. He's just been waiting for me to do it, and he's in Southern California. He says, if Martians were intelligent enough to develop nuclear technology powerful enough to remove the Martian atmosphere, then wouldn't they have been smart enough to bring their technology to Earth? If so, where are they?
Well, whatever happened on this event that happened on Mars, which is basically impossible to explain in terms of any natural phenomenon that we know of, apparently occurred like half a billion. There were not even cockroaches. Half a billion years.
Hold on, John. Hold it a minute. I'm losing you. You're somehow cutting out or fading out.
Here, let me make sure.
Is your phone okay?
The phone's okay. I just held it away from my mouth, and it has a. So I'll hold it. I'll make sure it's right next to my mouth.
Okay.
Okay. So life on Earth was very primitive at this time. So, and we're talking about events which precede the dinosaurs even. The only thing that it lines up with on Earth, by the way, and I've mentioned this in my book several times, is it should be investigated, the Great Permian Extinction. 250 million years ago, almost everything on Earth died. And it's a complete mystery. There's no sign of a big impact. The sea, all the turned to dead, and there is no with a plausible cause for why this occurred.
So
it occurred about the same time as this thing on Mars happened.
So in response to Doug's question, this was before Earth was habitated with anything like people
at the time.
Yeah.
So I don't think anyone would have been interested. It was a swamp with dragonflies with 12-foot wingspans.
So the question is, where did, I don't even know what to say other than just say people. We'll just use people loosely here. Where did the Martian people go who caused this, or did they blow themselves up?
The working hypothesis that I have put forth in the book Death on Mars is that Mars, you know, apparently had no advanced civilization on it. Whoever did this came to Mars from space, saw something on Mars, a primitive civilization like Egyptian level, making pyramids and big carved faces, and nuked them. Now, why would they do that?
I don't know. Why do they cut people's heads off? So
right. I mean, you have to look at intelligent life can do some very unintelligent things sometimes.
So you're saying basically Mars as a planet was invaded and destroyed.
It wasn't really invaded. It was
just destroyed.
It was destroyed by yet another species. And normally when scientists look at problems, we apply what's called an economy of hypothesis. You know, you Occam's razor.
Right.
The minimum number of entities. The connection I have made with things at Cydonia is that the two radioactive scars, the impact points of these explosions, are directly upwind of places where we found things that look like archaeology, eroded archaeology. But that looks itself like a very primitive civilization. It doesn't look like it would have had nuclear weapons. And if they did have nuclear weapons, why would they set them off? Why would they set off two great big ones upwind of themselves? It doesn't make any sense. It's the only thing that we've seen that resembles things that we have seen on Earth is an advanced civilization wiping out a primitive civilization. We're talking the disparity between the technology we've inferred from the radioactive, you know, the nuclear data. And what looks like very crude archaeology, if it's archaeology at all, you couldn't ask for a more pathetic and astonishing difference in the technologies that we're talking about.
You have two questions, emailers asking essentially the same question. Couldn't it be a lot smaller bombs?
There are not a lot of little radioactive hotspots on Mars. There's just two big ones. And you can see that when you go online, look for maps of potassium on Mars and maps of thorium on Mars. I asked the person, why are there no maps of uranium? Since the Russians measured measured uranium on the surface. Using the same techniques, they didn't map it, they just kind of measured it with a bunch of data points. And I got the funny answer that, uranium's too complicated to measure, so we didn't map it. But in any case, potassium and thorium are mapped on Mars, and you can see two red hot spots, both overlapping for each of them.
Well, I'm looking at thorium now, and they look more like they're purple.
It depends on which the graphs I have they're red.
Okay, so I'm looking at projections. I'm not looking at a graph.
These are maps.
Yeah, I'm looking at maps.
Map, you know, thorium map and potassium map.
Okay, so I have to scroll down I see what you're talking about.
Yeah, they're on the web, and you can see for yourselves where they are. One's at about, they're both at about latitude 50. And one is at about 35 west. The other is about 90 degrees east, you know, from the meridian. So, yeah, so there's a large pattern rather than a bunch of little hot spots. There's two big ones.
So what's next with what's the next level? Where do you take it from here?
Oh, well, assuming, well, I would, you know, I put forth an article on this. It was on Journal of Cosmology. Unfortunately, the website crashed because too many people tried to download it at once. I'm trying to get them to get that thing back up again.
Is the article on there now?
Yes. And anyone who wants a copy of the article, I can actually send it to them. They can send me a message at spaceranger137@yahoo.com. I will provide them with a preprint.
spaceranger137@yahoo.com?
At Yahoo, and I will send them a preprint.
Why didn't you do Space Ranger at Xenon 129?
129? If I didn't know anything about this when I first did the... by the way, the first place we reported this, we found it, was to the Defense Department.
And what did they do? Did they come and investigate?
They, well, no, they took this very seriously. The official we spoke to took a lot of notes, looked very sober, and he went and reported it to whoever he reports to. And then 6 months later, they sent back a message. And typical of the people we're dealing with, their answer to my question was itself a question. They said, "Why don't you publish?"
What's the name of your article?
It's called Evidence for Large Thermonuclear Explosions on Mars. And it's been the website has been up and down. They said they crashed their website.
Send it to me, okay?
I will.
Do you want me to put it on the blog?
Put it on the blog.
I have permission to do that?
Yes.
And the Journal of Cosmology doesn't care?
No.
All right, so if you get it to me...
I will, but the real article is like 12 megabytes. Can you handle that?
Yeah, it's a PDF, right?
Yeah, it's a PDF.
Yeah, I should be able to get it. If not, you can send it via wetransfer.com.
Yeah, we'll figure out a way.
And
get it on your website
and then,
so everyone can see it.
Then when I archive the show, either late tonight or early tomorrow morning, I'll post it on the blog, and in the summary I'll say this is your paper, and then people can take it right off the blog.
Yeah, when I presented it at the American Physical Society to a bunch of physicists and students, and they all looked horrified. And I got a lot of questions.
Horrified because they thought it was junk or because it's not, there was a nuclear explosion on Mars?
Well, the scale of the nuclear explosion, the evidence that there may have been something downwind of it, that it was being targeted, I thought they reacted like I would expect people to react to news like that. They looked horrified, and there were no giggles.
I have another email from Doug, who I wish would call in, but maybe he's at the clinic and he can't call today. He says, no, this is going to be in support of your craziness, so listen to this. listen, you have to know.
Or should I wait till I hear?
Listen, you have to know that John Brandenburg is one of these guys I met when the space show was just starting years and years and years ago, and as you can tell, we naturally got along right off the bat, and I didn't know anything about nuclear stuff on Mars or anything, but you know, we had a lot of common interest points, and we've been good friends. And he sent me his book. This is a really funny story. So he sent me his book, and he keeps saying, "Have you gotten it? No, it hadn't come. So finally, I get this crazy padded envelope in my P.O. box that is absolutely empty except for a catalog from his publisher, which is AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com. And the envelope has been opened by a letter opener. I scanned the envelope on both sides and sent it to John, because this has never happened
before.
Whoever did
this was good at this.
Yeah, and there,
they
there's
didn't tear it open. They actually just slid it with some kind of lever, very
right,
sharp device.
So he sent it to my old address. It got forwarded to my P.O. box, and it has a note on it from the post office that says, return to sender, postage due. And they didn't send it back to the sender, but the book was not in the package. So John said this is the first time he's ever had a book stolen out of the mail, that someone wanted it so badly they had to steal the damn book. I've had packages lost in the mail, and I've had packages damaged in the mail, but the envelope was delivered empty except for this stupid little catalog, and the book was gone. So they ripped off his book from the envelope on purpose.
That's funny, they didn't take the catalog.
Yeah, and you could see from the envelope that they actually opened the envelope on purpose.
Yep.
It wasn't torn or damaged and the book fell out. Somebody opened it to rip off your book.
Well, I hope they're enjoying this. I hope they enjoy the book.
Anyway, Doug says, from my eyeballing of the Martian thorium map and comparing it to the Martian topographic map, it seems that there is a nearly exact match between the major thorium hotspot, Northern Hemisphere, I think Sidonian region, and a topographic depression. Both are down-pointing triangles in shape. Can you explain this correlation between the thorium and the natural topography?
Yes, there does seem to be a very wide, shallow depression associated with the thorium hotspot and the potassium hotspot. The potassium hotspot and the thorium hotspot are slightly offset from each other, by the way. It's like one, I'm not exactly sure why, but both hotspots show this. Yes, there's a broad, shallow depression. Now, the whole Mare Acidalium area is a area of low elevation, surrounded by, on one side, the volcanic Tharsis area. Plateau starts to the east, to the west, and the, all the big volcanoes are very far to the west, by the way. Then the Cydonia area starts to the east, and you have a broad, shallow, it looks like that was part of the ocean, northern polar ocean basin, and leads down to Chrysi, which is where the Viking lander landed, and that's below what is called the zero-kilometer line on Mars. The zero-kilometer is determined by the triple point of water, where the pressure will allow liquid water below that elevation. So actually, liquid water can exist in that area briefly before it freezes. So, I hope that answers his question.
Well, if not, we'll hear from him. And John Hunt has been sending in, I think, a lot of just fun questions, which I haven't been reading to you. But he says, Stephen Hawking is probably right. It looks like E.T. is out there, and he isn't very friendly.
If you believe in the principle of mediocrity, which was championed by Sagan and Yukofsky in their book Intelligent Life in the Universe, first place I read about it. And, like I said, if you want to know what intelligent life acts like in the universe, turn on the news.
That's what I was going to say. Go up and visit the government in Washington, D.C.
Or read my science fiction novels.
Your science fiction novels are better.
One of my friends who's also is a poet, I explained to him the basic discovery of the two heroines of my novel when they're bringing down the... which I write under. I write science fiction under the pen name Victor Norgard, by the way.
Yes.
Separated from my science.
Yeah, because you create all these fictitious women that you don't want associated with you. So. And then you put them on the cover of the book to get all the Space Cadet guys to buy the book.
Absolutely.
This is Marketing 101.
Absolutely. If I put two beautiful women on the cover, it would sell, and it did.
What about Fermi's paradox?
Fermi's paradox.
Yeah.
Now that is another big one that is connected with the article, is the fact that, and the first person to discover this was Enrico Fermi, a brilliant physicist, and he basically said that, you know, the human race is here. We don't seem that remarkable. We kind of believed in the principle of mediocrity. And he said, we're very noisy. And we're also, you know, he's Italian, like Columbus, and he, in fact, that was his first message when he discovered nuclear chain reactions. He said, Columbus has decided America. And so human beings are very, very exploratory and very noisy. And we don't seem like anything special. He just lived through World War II and had to rescue his Jewish wife from the Holocaust. That's why he fled Europe, because of his wife. And so there he was working on the hydrogen bomb in Los Alamos after World War II. And he's sitting there thinking about extraterrestrial life and intelligence, and he finally just announces to everybody at the lunch table, who included Edward Teller, where the hell are they? Pardon me. Where the heck are they? We're on radio.
Well, we're on internet radio.
And everybody knew what he meant. He said, you know, we should have a, we're new in the universe, we're young, the universe is old, there should be all sorts of people out there like us. Why don't we see any soap operas? Everywhere we point our satellite, our radio telescopes, which they had by then, they should be picking up political propaganda, soap operas, used car commercials, etc. Instead, there's nothing. Silence. And this remains, well, in fact, that's why, you know, ask Seth Shoshak, you know, why haven't you picked up anything? And he'll say, Fermi's paradox. We should be picking up stuff. If human life is typical of the universe, we should be picking up stuff, and we're not. It's as if the universe is a ghost town. The universe is awash in the stuff of life: amino acids, water, carbon dioxide, methane. All of that is out in the stars, between the stars, in abundance. The universe is one big smorgasbord for the chemical precursors for life. And now we're looking at for planets. We're finding every star apparently has planets, at least every single star. Binary star systems, that's apparently more difficult. But every single star apparently has planets. So there's lots of places to live out there, and there's lots of stuff to make life out of it. Why is it so quiet? It's like an old Western where, you know, Festus says to Marshall Dillon, it's real quiet out there, Marshall, and Marshall Dillon says, yeah, it's too quiet.
So where are they?
Well, maybe we go out to Mars and we'll find out why they're so quiet.
So you don't know why they're where they are?
No, I don't. But this is why I'm advocating that our response to this discovery on Mars, which I believe will be verified, is to send astronauts to Mars as soon as possible to discover exactly what happened up there in depth. And that means you have to send people up there digging with shovels who have sharp eyes and can spot stuff.
Tim sent you an email. Did you perform calculations on how much of the atmosphere would be lost by this nuke explosion?
No, that would really require specialized codes like our at Livermore and Los Alamos.
Why?
Because it's a complex hydrodynamic calculation. It's basically you're talking propagating shock waves in a atmosphere that varies in density with altitude.
So you don't have that kind of computer power is what you're
saying? No, I don't.
Okay.
There are only a few places that do.
Okay, now the next question is from Kirk again, and who, by the way, is in a safe area. No nuke is going to go off in Trinidad. So
he's
doing fine down there. I could believe that an advanced interstellar civilization or their autonomous agents might choose to sterilize planets with new developing intelligent species. By the way, wasn't there a Star Trek show about the planet killer that was roaming the galaxy and swallowing up and destroying planets?
That's right. That didn't leave any planets behind. That actually...
That's right.
They used the planets as fuel.
So I don't... Maybe maybe you know, the planet killer from Star Trek got, you know, was headed
right
over toward,
well,
Mars.
There's a hypothesis put forward by an astronomer named Edward Harrison called the, you know, Harrison scenario. And he basically said that the answer to Fermi's paradox is that intelligence in the cosmos is predatory and eliminates competition. Advanced civilizations try and get rid of young civilizations, nip them in the bud, as he aptly put it.
And, well, then we're kind of wannabes here on Earth, aren't we?
Well, we're very noisy. We're in the ghost town that is the cosmos. We are holding a rock concert.
Okay, let me read you the rest of Kirk's question. I believe an advanced interstellar civilization or their autonomous agents might choose to sterilize planets with new developing intelligent species. That would be one explanation of the Fermi paradox. But just how practical would it be to create a weapon of the size you are describing? Wouldn't it be easier to divert an asteroid to bring about a planet-wide extinction event?
If your object is to sterilize a planet, then the long-lived radionuclides from a very large nuclear explosion that has a uranium and thorium jacket, will make sure that the planet does not recover. The biosphere will be poisoned radioactively and will not recover.
And an asteroid.
The recovery of biology on Earth after the Chicxulub impact, you know, which was just an asteroid,
right,
was fairly quick.
So an asteroid you'll recover from over its time,
right?
But not an Empire State Building nuke.
No. Mars would stay dead after that.
So what's so? Is the only next step to mount a human mission to go there, and where would you go?
You could land a rover.
Where?
In Mare Acidalium.
Okay.
And start, you could do a sample return mission from Mare Acidalium, sample the rocks, and there are people I know of at Los Alamos and Livermore. You gave them a piece of rock from Mare Acidalium, they would tell you in an afternoon.
What would they tell you?
How big the nuke was and what was in it.
Even a Martian nuke?
Yes.
Well?
Well, let's just say it would become very apparent to them. They would know just what to look for if it was a nuclear explosion like I have described, and they could rule it in or rule it out very quickly if they had a sample of rock from the center of that hot spot. And that could be done entirely by robots.
Well, there's no mission plan there, is there?
No. The missions that we have are far, far away from those places. Gale Crater and Gusev Crater.
Yeah, do you think that's on purpose?
No, I don't think so. I think those were geologically the most interesting. I mean, we're getting fabulous data from both places.
How do you?
Especially now, Gale Crater. Mike, you saw the pictures of those sedimentary rocks.
Uh-huh, yeah, amazing.
I'm doing a paper just on that. You know, what does it mean when you look at what is supposed to be a middle of geologic history formation on Mars, and it shows what looks like old ocean bed. That means the ocean lasted until the middle of Mars history, if not longer. It looks like a road cut here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, or just driving through the West.
That's right. The Midwest used to be the bottom of a shallow ocean called the Inland Sea during the time of the dinosaurs, and a lot of the sedimentary rocks are very beautiful layers, just like we're finding on Mars. It looks absolutely Earth-like. And that's, you know, so in one sense, what I have talked about could not have been possible except for the mammoth Mars research program that this nation has, and the Europeans, and to some extent even the Russians, have done. All of this data is from open source. And it's just amazing to watch the human race attack a problem. The human race is obsessed with Mars. Now I know why. I think subconsciously they know something bad happened up there, and the human race, being afflicted with morbid curiosity, just is going to keep chewing on this bone until it finally figures it out.
Well, of course, the politicians who spring for the money don't seem to be obsessed with it.
Mars, I used to have an equation written on my board. It was the symbol of Mars, you know, the male symbol, equals a dollar sign. And that is true. We have spent billions and billions and billions of dollars on Mars now. Why are we spending so much money on Mars? Because we know that it's the first Earth-like planet in the cosmos we can look at. If life is elsewhere, we will probably show, it'll probably be seen on, the evidence of it is seen on Mars. In fact, it's already been seen. You know, people don't find it convincing, but it's certainly evidence.
How do I, so I can give listeners more information, how do I spell Maras Adalium?
M-A-R-E, or it's also Acidalia Planitia, but Acidalia is just spelled like acid, like sulfuric acid.
Uh-huh.
And Dahlia as A-L-I-A.
Or something like that.
Something like that. You can do a Google search. Mare Acidalium or Acidalia Planitia. Those are two alternative geologic names. By the way, the fascinating thing about what they're finding at Gale Crater, not only are the sediments in these beautiful layers, but the sediments are bright red. They're highly oxidized. They're full of red ferric iron, just like on Earth.
Right.
And that suggests that the Martian atmosphere was full of oxygen when they were laid down, just like on Earth. The dinosaurs did not breathe carbon dioxide and methane. They breathed oxygen just like we did. In fact, they breathed a lot of it. There's some suggestion that Earth may have had more oxygen in its atmosphere during the age of the dinosaurs, and that's why the dinosaurs could be so big and ferocious. So those sediments, you can tell, were laid down in an oxidizing atmosphere.
Interesting.
Oh, yes. And
okay, but I'm still trying. What's the next step to confirm your theories? I mean, we're not going there.
I would say...
Because we're not going there anytime soon.
Oh, who knows? The government may like my theory and not say so. Uncle Sammy may play his cards very close to the chest.
What, and launch a secret? Come on, this is B-rated movies are made of.
That we're going to Mars faster than we thought we were going to go. Actually, no. I believe this will be, as people investigate this, just like I said, you can go on the web and find these thorium and potassium maps. Other scientists will investigate this, and I believe they will arrive at the same conclusion I have. I have been doing this science business for a long time.
No, I know. Do you have a chat
room? I don't like to be wrong, Dave. I like to be right.
Do you have a chat room or something where people can engage you in high-quality discussion?
I engaged a bunch of people when the thing first came out. You can actually see those dialogues on the web. If you do a web search, Brandenburg, thermonuclear Mars, you'll find there's the two faces of Brandenburg, and then there's also another one. There were actually aliens on Mars, and they nuked each other. That's another one. These are kind of the top of the Google pile that piles up when you do that web search.
Okay.
And you can see a rather long, in some cases, bruising dialogue between me and various characters. And I think I knocked everyone else out of the ring, finally. I was the last man standing. Like I said, I don't like to be wrong, Dave.
Well,
I like to be right, and I've been right.
I just
about every time as a scientist.
I just want to see it confirmed. And
Well, I believe it will be confirmed.
And you know, maybe Elon will get there before the rest of everybody else.
Well, I'm sure Elon is aware of it.
Have you talked to him about it?
No. I talked to him about other things, but I never mentioned this to him. We were talking about how to get to Mars.
Yeah.
Not what was on Mars. Why do I have to sell him on going to Mars? He already wants to go to Mars.
He already wants to go, yeah.
See, I am trying to sell the rest of the human race on why we should go to Mars. We have to find out what happened there so we make sure it doesn't happen to us. That's why we go to Mars.
Listener,
go to Mars because we want to make sure this doesn't happen to us.
Listeners, his book is fascinating, Death on Mars, The Discovery of a Planetary Nuclear Massacre. You can get it on Amazon, and you can go through the One Giant Leap Foundation portal, and Amazon will contribute a portion of your purchase price back to the space show. Or if you use Smile and you select the Amazon nonprofit One Giant Leap Foundation, Smile will also donate part of your purchase price to the space show, although using the One Giant Leap portal results in a lot bigger donation than the smile.amazon.com site. But either way, the book is worth having. You should read it. He's got great pictures in it, including color pictures that are very relevant, as well as some black and white pictures, maps. The book is documented. It's footnoted. It's very professionally done. And
I even have nude pictures of both the heroines from my science fiction novel in there. Throw that in.
Okay, I wasn't going to throw that in, but
never mind.
We'll leave that.
We'll leave that aside.
We'll leave that. But I do recommend that you get a hold of the book, and we'll talk to John some more about this. I think this is the third time we've talked about this topic on the show, and he keeps evolving his theory because the first couple of times they were natural nuclear explosions. So we've evolved now.
The dog didn't bark is the problem. The dog didn't bark. The problem with the old theory was it didn't explain why the dog didn't bark. And so, you know how scientists like me are. We keep fussing with things.
Absolutely.
We keep pulling at that one loose string on the sweater, and suddenly the whole thing falls apart. And then we're left with something else.
What's next? Do you have another sci-fi book about to come out? Or
Oh yeah. I'm doing the sequel to the Morningstar Path, The Collapse of the UFO Cover-Up.
Uh-huh.
Where, of course, the Asian heroine wakes up in the hospital and can't remember anything.
That's no fun.
Her boyfriend, the hero, the Green Beret.
Uh-huh.
He gets discharged from the hospital. In fact, they're discharging him in a hurry because the French are after him. Even though he's gotten a medal from the U.S. government, the French have now accused him of war crimes since he was involved in the UFO cover-up.
What's the name of this book?
This is going to be To Rule the Night.
And when can we find it?
Oh, probably later this year.
Well, you'll have to let me know so we can talk about it.
Absolutely. You'll love this book, Dave.
Is there another...
He goes crazy and does all sorts of crazy things.
Just like you.
her boyfriend comes and the hero comes and asks her to marry him as he's leaving the hospital. And she says, if you really loved me, you would have left me to die in that place.
You need
so he's kind of fumbling around with his Green Beret, and I guess he says, well, I guess that's no. So he leaves.
Do you have another?
She turns his back on him, and he looks at her from behind and thinks, yes, this was all worth it, but I have to go. And so he leaves, and then she turns around and says, wait, I'm not finished.
Well, don't tell us the ending.
This is the beginning.
What's next?
She tries to pursue him outside the hospital, but he's already gone. And
sorry.
She says, I wasn't finished.
What's next for your nuclear explosions on Mars?
Well,
I'm trying to encourage a group of scientists and experts on this to form a committee, look at all the evidence, and give their own conclusion, and then report that to their congressman.
Are you making progress on that?
I have just begun.
Okay. Well, let us know what that happens with that, too, okay?
Yes. Well, I'm going to be putting a paper into the Lunar Planetary Science Conference on this subject.
Okay.
It'll be, you know, it'll basically just be, look, the natural nuclear reactor hypothesis no longer functions. We're left with anomalous nuclear explosions. We have no natural explanation for them. So basically, I'm just going to update all the data, and especially the trinitite at the two sites, indicating explosion in midair with a fireball at both sites, forming a lot of nitric acid, just like a regular nuclear explosion. So we formed glass and then etched it with nitric acid. And so I'm going to be presenting that, assuming my paper gets accepted. And I will stand and ask, and I'll basically be asking other people, well, what do you think? Is there some phenomenon you can think of? Let's say a uranium asteroid penetrated Mars' atmosphere and went supercritical, became a nuclear reactor in midair. Can that explain it? It can't, by the way. It would have blown up before it reached Mars. And so it's a real mystery.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at there, John. I have a 4 o'clock
hey, Dave,
meeting.
Thank you for being open minded enough to
bring me
on your show.
I love having you on the show. It's not only a lot of fun. I learn a lot of things from you, and it's been that way for the last 15 years or however long we've known
each other.
That's
right, Dave.
So.
We're going to keep talking about this till we're finally on Mars.
That's right.
Landing on Mars. By the way, the next time we talk, it'll probably be about my sequel, Science. You'll be talking to Victor Norgard.
Okay, well, I want to...
On the sequel.
I want to talk to the two twins, so...
Oh, they have plenty to say in this book.
Bring them on.
Three quarters of it. They have lots
to say. I'm still waiting to meet them, so bring them on the show. John, a very happy New Year to you, and
happy New Year.
Send me your
thanks again for having me on your show.
Yeah, and send me your paper. Send me your paper, and I'll put it up on the blog when I archive the show.
Okay, I'll send you the Journal of Cosmology, and also send you the preprint, which is smaller.
Okay,
so you'll have that too. It may have a few typos in it, but it's a preprint. At least it's smaller.
Should I put the preprint up on the blog then?
No, let's put the
real one up.
Put the real one up.
Okay.
It's got all the figures bigger.
Okay.
And so everybody will see it better.
Hold on. I think you just got a question. Yeah. So, listeners, this is the last one because I've got a meeting to go to and we're way over. But this is from Gerald, and he says, interesting show, but I'm reserving judgment. Yesterday I tuned into 365 and an Open Lines rerun from the previous Sunday. Did I tune into the wrong... Okay, you tuned into the wrong place. So
there you go. Your question is answered.
We're all reserving judgment, Gerald. I probably had turned the show off, and you were back on to archives. So if you're on Live 365, listeners, unless there is a live show going on, then you're going to get archives for the week, and they play at a random rate. And if there's a live show going on, you will get the live show on Live 365, but I convert it back right after the live show ends. So it depends on when you actually tuned in, and that's probably what happened. You missed the live show, and then you got the archives going again. All right, my friend, I will be in touch. A very happy New Year to you and your family.
Very good. Happy New Year to everyone.
Thank you, John. And listeners, back tomorrow night. Look on the newsletters. A good show. And we look forward to hearing from all of you again. Bye from John Brandenburg and the Space Show.
Very good.